Hello, everyone, and thanks for listening. Today, we've got Dawson Church here with us on Healing of Agape, and Dawson's just working on a new book with Norm Shealy called Soul Medicine. How are you, Dawson?
Doing very well, Eva. Thanks for having me here.
You might need to speak up just a little bit.
Okay, sure, how's that now?
That's better, that's better, good. That's good. So before we get started on the interview, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and where we can find you on the Internet and where we can find a copy of your book. It's not out yet, is it?
It's shipping in June, so in the next 2 to 4 weeks, it'll be available in all Barnes & Noble and Borders stores, and Amazon has copies now. And as far as the website goes, we try and post all of the best practices we come across on our website at soulmedicineinstitute.com. And that has links to schools that teach these methods. It has links to individual practitioners by state. It has links to all the therapies we think have the most potential to affect people's lives positively right now.
Now, what is your background, then, Dawson?
I have been writing about and researching healing for about 30 years. I trained as a vibrational healer in, the 70s, I suppose. And then I put together a seminal anthology on healing called The Heart of Healing in the mid-80s. And it had many luminaries like Larry Darcy and Bernie Siegel. Mm-hmm. They all wrote chapters for that anthology. And that really got me launched in the publishing world as well. So I've written and edited now many books on wellness as well. So researching, compiling, and writing on the topic.
And you have a PhD, don't you? What is that in?
It is in holistic medicine.
And really? I didn't know that existed.
Yes, it is. And in fact, Norm Shealy, my co-author on the book Soul Medicine, was my dissertation chair. And during the course of writing my dissertation and defending it, the idea came forward that we might put together his enormous clinical experience together with my research skills and write a book that really defines where medicine is going right now.
And this book, I've read over the manuscript for it. It's science. It's hard science, isn't it? It's not it's stuff that's been researched through what I call the priesthood of science, and it's not woo-woo stuff. So, I mean, you've got proof that there's proof exists that this works.
It's a secular priesthood, but they cling to their ideas often more fervently than any religious fanatic. But yes, yeah, we use only articles that have appeared in peer-reviewed scientific journals, reputable journals. We don't use any what I call fringe science because it's not necessary. What we say in the first chapter of this book is that 20 years ago, this would have been a book based on metaphysical ideas. Today, it's a book based on hard science. There is so much good, reputable science available, so many studies demonstrating the effects of consciousness, of intention, of energy on matter, that there's no need to delve into aspects of science that aren't recognized by the mainstream at all. Mm-hmm. There's just a ton of good work available that draws only on journals like the American Medical Association Journal, Journal of Clinical Psychology, and sources like that.
Now, I'm curious, have you presented this information to, I don't know anything else to call it, but the priesthood, but have you presented it to those, to any of those people, and what kind of response do you get?
We aim to write these books so that they can be used as textbooks or alternate texts in medical schools. So we're using a fairly high standard of writing and proof. And so the books have just come out, but I suspect that it will be picked up by a number of schools. We also are calling at the end of Soul Medicine for a reputable accreditation of energy medicine healers. And there are a number of efforts underway in this regard, but we feel that there should be something like an MD or a PhD degree that allows the public to know when they when they see such a person that they have a certain high level of background and training and a knowledge base in these fields. So we're advocating that that an alternative MD basically be established over the course of the next 10 years or so that that allows people seeking medical treatment or psychological help to know that people with that degree have a level of safe and effective techniques that they've learned and can apply.
Right. I don't think that Western medicine is bad. I just don't think it encompasses all that there is. And
well,
I don't
what,
think,
what we're
I think
saying,
it's much
what we
less
advocate,
invasive what you do.
Yeah. Well, what we believe is that it's excellent for certain kinds of conditions, chronic infections, fractures, trauma, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What it's very poor at treating is what we call the diseases of modernity, things like chronic fatigue syndrome, lupus, all of the autoimmune diseases. It grapples with it. It has no real idea how to do much more than ameliorate some of the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we really are pushing for is that people will when they have a condition, first of all, recognize whether it's one of the few conditions for which allopathic medicine is well suited, and then go straight to their doctor or hospital. But
mm-hmm.
if it's one of the many diseases or conditions for which allopathic medicine is not suited, and that number, by the way, is about 84% of doctor's visits. 84% of doctor visits, according to an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 84% are not for any identifiable organic disease.
Mm-hmm.
Only 16% of doctor's visits are for an actual diagnosable condition. So for those conditions, by all means, go and see your doctor. But if you don't have one of those limited number of conditions, we strongly advocate that people try safe, effective, non-invasive therapies first. And
mm-hmm.
only if those fail, then go and look and see what allopathic medicine has to offer for that condition. But the first line of defense should be some of these amazing new therapies, because they are proving remarkably effective, even with things like very, very serious diseases.
Well, let's talk about one. You brought up chronic fatigue syndrome, and I've kind of been battling with that lately. What would you suggest me to do for that?
Well, there are, I don't know how aware you are.
Understanding that you're not a medical doctor. Let's get that clear
yes,
first.
Right,
we don't
yeah.
get in trouble here. But from your experience, what would you suggest?
Well, I think that as a general principle, well, I'll give you an example from another condition. I did a presentation last year to a group of people suffering from carpal tunnel syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Now, carpal tunnel syndrome comes from repetitive motion injury. It's an injury caused by using usually a keyboard or some other device repetitively for a long time. However, these people asked me back to do a second presentation a few months later on the underlying emotional aspects of their condition, because during my first presentation, which was purely about some exercises that are very useful for relieving carpal tunnel, it became very obvious to people listening that a huge component of their physical condition, and this includes chronic fatigue, is emotional. And so
mm-hmm.
when you address the emotional issues, then one of two things happens.
Let me ask you a question. What emotional issue did you find in carpal tunnel?
There was no overriding emotional issue, but one, you know, for example, one of the ladies in the group, her mother had died, and she'd been very close to her mother. She'd been taking care of her mother, and her mother's death left her distraught, and so her condition worsened after that. So we worked on relieving her grief and her guilt. Her grief that her mother had died and her guilt that her mother had died while she was in this woman's care. This woman was a nurse as well, and but she was completely disabled. She had actually a very serious form of repetitive strain affecting her rib cage that made her completely unable to work or hardly to function, even to drive. So she reported enormous relief. She began by being so distraught when she described her mother's death. She would just burst out crying whenever she talked about this after literally 5 minutes of energy interventions with her. She was able to describe her mother's death and say, you know, it was sad, but I can talk about it now without crying. So she had perspective on her condition.
Mm-hmm.
So once you resolve these underlying emotional aspects, then you might find that position clears up. Now, you might find it doesn't clear up, or you might find it clears up partially, and that's usually what most people experience, is they'll resolve the underlying emotional trauma, and then whatever component that was contributing to their physical disease is taken away, and then you can see what remains in the physical disease, that often, even for serious diseases, big chunks of it will disappear, and chronic fatigue is one of those. It's very hard, almost impossible to treat medically, allopathically, but with emotional work, huge shifts are possible.
So let's talk for just a minute about epigenetics. That's something that really interests me. What have you found out about that? And epigenetics, why don't you tell the listeners what that is?
Epigenetics refers to changes in gene function that occur from outside the cell, that occur as a result of the environment the cell exists in. So that's why epi, outside of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this model, actually a very, very harmful model has been present in our social consciousness for the last 50 or so years, which talks about and thinks about genes as determining many parts of our physical function and even our behavior. And, you know, obvious things like, you know, height, eye color, and so on are clearly linked to our genes. But what's happened is that when we identified those physical characteristics, then suddenly the hunt was on for a gene for everything. And this led, unfortunately, to the assumption that we're just born that way. We're the way we are because we're born that way. We have this genetic makeup. It's fixed. We simply have to live out the dictates of our genes. And nothing could be further from the truth. There are many triggers that turn genes on and off. And genes are turned on and off, or they expressed in technical language. Genes are expressed because of signals they receive from the environment outside the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And those signals include signals from our thoughts and feelings. So, for example, there's a class of genes called the immediate early genes, or IEGs. And these genes express, and there are roughly 100 of these IE genes. So about 24,000 genes, about 100 of them are early genes, immediate early genes. They express within 1, 2, or 3 seconds of us having a thought or feeling or experience. So, for example, if someone runs at you with a spear threatening you, within 1.5 seconds or so, a whole bunch of early genes kick in, get expressed, and they produce what's called the fight-or-flight syndrome. And we've known about this for years. We know these genes turn on when this happens. We know very well what happens when this kind of threat is present. What we have not appreciated fully is that when we have a thought, an angry thought, or a thought of somebody attacking us or attacking them, or a feeling, especially a strong feeling, of that same thing happening. So when you think, my boss, I hate my boss was miserable and mean, my wife was, my kid was, my dog was, the driver in the next lane was, whoever we blame it on, when we have that thought or feeling, the biochemical event in our bodies is identical to the caveman running at us with a spear. And while we don't have caveman running at us with spears very often, we do have these thoughts very often, and it's getting control of those thoughts that is critical to our health, because these immediate early genes, actually the fight-or-flight mechanism shuts down our immune system and diverts blood away from our brains, away from our digestive tracts, away from our whole immune function, and to our muscles for, you know, quick response to an enemy. So we're, in fact, turning genes on and off in every moment by the quality of our thinking and feeling, and it's entirely within our own control.
I didn't realize it was genes that did that. I thought it was chemicals like cortisol and stuff like adrenaline.
Those
I didn't realize it was chemicals.
Are produced as a result of signals that come from the genes. So the immediate early genes turn on another class of genes called intermediate genes, And those then affect the production of things like cortisol and adrenaline on down the road. When a gene expresses, eventually it usually produces a protein. So a protein is assembled where a protein is activated because of the action of a gene. And the proteins are what does the work of the body. It's what is responsible for the structure of our cells called microtubules. Proteins are responsible for most of the function of our immune system. So proteins are the end result of healing of wounds is all about proteins. So the proteins are the end result, but they're triggered by genes. And genes are triggered epigenetically by the environment around the cells, and that includes the environment of our own thoughts and feelings.
Interesting. Now I want to ask you one question that just comes from my own experience. But when I get through with this, I want to go back to something that Christine Page was telling me, so don't let me forget, about the unraveling of the gene through intention. So don't let me forget about that.
But okay.
In my own experience, you know, I have this gift of medical intuition and channeling, and one thing that I started getting when I started writing about this was that when people have negative emotions, they get this sense of heightened awareness that's about 2 inches above their navel, about 2 or 3 inches in, discounting any body fat. You know, kind of like that feeling you get when a policeman stops you and you see that blue light, that kind of sick feeling.
Yes.
And I hear in my head that when you get that feeling, that it sends an impulse to the heart, and this is actually why I started researching with Rowan at HeartMath. And then the heart would send an impulse to the brain, and then the brain would interpret that, and that was what causes various organs to get sick, because that emotion was interpreted by the brain, and each emotion is associated with a particular organ or body system, and that would cause you to get sick. So what would be happening there?
I think that we're a long way from identifying particular thoughts which have an effect on particular systems scientifically. So intuitively, or for example, when I meditate every morning, I feel my body shudders. It's almost orgasmic. I feel this is shaking my body. It's a powerful feeling, and I don't know why it happens, but I'm pretty sure that it's a genetic effect. There's some kind of gene activation happening during that process, because I feel flooded with bliss afterwards. So something's going on there. But we're, in terms of experiments, we're babes, not even in the woods yet. We're just figuring out the links between these things. And what I suspect will happen in the next 100 years in medicine and psychology is that we will get to the point where we know the exact link between certain thoughts and emotions and certain diseases. We're not there yet. I think the closest we can come is medical intuition. And also I suspect, and I have no proof of this, but I suspect that the gurus who prescribe a mantra for a student, and there are many Indian gurus who will say, you know, repeat this mantra X number of times. I suspect what they're doing is they have somehow figured out or been able to become sensitive to the exact set of verbal frequencies that those words evoke for that student and how that can be applied in healing. So I suspect that in the next 100 years, one facet of this is that one of my contributors, one of my books, is James Dillard. And Dr. Dillard wrote the book called The Comprehensive Pain Solution, and is regarded as one of the foremost pain medicine doctors in the U.S. And one day a patient came to him in severe pain, and he picked up his prescription pad and he wrote on it, long talks with your rabbi twice a week, and gave it to the patient. The patient walked out and did just that, went to his rabbi and began to really commune with him on a deep level a couple of times a week. And it in one of my books, I think in Soul Medicine, actually, I described this. It totally changed the patient's life. So at a certain point, we will, I think, get to the stage where doctors are able to identify the exact combination of thoughts and feelings and ideas and words that will trigger healing of a particular ailment. But all we can say with scientific certainty at this stage is that we know there's an effect, but we don't know in detail how to produce these effects for particular conditions, particular patients right now. We will in time, but we're in the very early stages of research right now. The best you can do, I think, is tuning into yourself or using medical intuition or using a spiritual teacher who can help guide you.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I was talking about with Christine, who were talking about the power of intention, I think she said it was Bruce Lipton's book, but I've not finished reading that yet, so I don't know. She said that scientists or some people had gathered and they wanted to see if they could unravel this gene, and so they would place intention for this gene to unravel, and nothing would happen. She said finally they got to where they got into their minds that they were that the actual DNA, and when that they became the DNA became looser so that it would unravel.
Okay, what this was is a series of experiments, and I forget where these were published, but they were published in a journal, and I do have that reference. I think that reference actually is on my soulmedicineinstitute.com website. What happened was that the researchers had vials of human placental DNA, just ordered from a lab, sterile human placental DNA, and they asked the subjects to have the intention that the degree of twist of the DNA molecules either would become looser or become tighter. And there's a technique called hydrogen spectrography, which allows you to identify exactly what that degree of average degree of twist in a DNA sample is. So, you know, it's a double helix, it's in a spiral. Mm-hmm. How tight is the average spiral in that sample? And so some groups of volunteers were asked to have the intention that those spirals would get looser, and other groups were asked to have the intention that these spirals would get tighter, and the researchers then sent them back to the lab, measured the effect of the intention of the human subjects on the DNA. And what they found was essentially that regardless of who the person having the intention was, there was no effect on the DNA molecule. However, when subjects entered what the heart math people call a state of heart coherence, when your heart rate is very regular, our hearts normally beat, we average it out, but they beat very irregularly. They speed up, they slow down frequently. And in fact, the more diseased people are, usually the higher their heart rate variability is. People who are very calm are able to have very, very, very stable heart rates. And they found that when their volunteers entered the state of heart rate congruence, where their hearts were very, very stable, and then had the intention that the DNA samples indeed did twist tighter or looser, depending on the intention of the person. So even from a distance of 50 feet, actually even 5 miles in one experiment, they demonstrated that that the DNA did twist tighter or looser, depending on intention. So this opens up absolutely staggering implications for what we're doing to our DNA in certain heart rate states with our intentions and our consciousness.
Well, it certainly says a lot about genetic disorders, doesn't it?
It does.
What you can do to heal yourself from genetic disorder. I wonder how that would affect somebody that has, let's say autism that they've said for years is genetic.
You know, again, I think we're still at such early stages of research that the point at which we can identify particular intentions or ideas that'll affect certain conditions is a long way away. There are some experiments going on right now. I just talked actually to the founder of EFT, emotional freedom therapy, which is a very potent method. And in fact, it's what I was using with these carpal tunnel syndrome patients. I talked to him this morning, and they are doing studies now with people with cancer and also CFS. To see if it affects them, but again, we're probably several years away from clinical studies of those kinds of conditions.
Now, in your book or in your research, have you found that particular kinds of alternative medicine affect various diseases better or worse than other tops?
Yes, but it's highly variable, and it's highly variable for the person, because the person's belief has a great deal to do with it. If I believe homeopathy, you know, the British royal family, for example, has been treated by homeopathy for the last 150 years, so there's a very strong base of conviction there that homeopathy works. So if the physician has a strong belief system that homeopathy works, and a patient has a strong belief system, the chances are very good that homeopathy will work for them. And so the patient's belief and the doctor's belief is critical in making the system work. If I go in for chemotherapy or radiation for cancer with the conviction that they will work, they're more likely to work. We know from research, this is true, they're more likely to work for me than if I don't believe they'll work. So it's very important to engage the patient's belief system. And yet, having said that, there are some new therapies that, again, EFT, which I mentioned earlier, emotional freedom therapy. Intellectually, I don't really know how it works, and yet even when I don't believe it, it works. So they seem to have some independent efficacy, regardless of the patient's belief. So I think that, yes, there are certain conditions. For example, acupuncture, for the treatment of pain. Acupuncture has been shown to be effective for many different kinds of pain, and there's simply no doubt at this point in most researchers' or doctors' minds that that acupuncture is very effective. Is homeopathy as effective for the treatment of pain? I don't think so. There may be some preparations that can help or deal with the side effects.
Right.
But, I think it's, you know, generally speaking, I wouldn't go the homeopathic route if I were in pain. So reading your own body, learning to, you know, writing up your own owner's manual in your mind, and how do I work? When are my biorhythms up? When are they down? Are there times of the month when I am sadder and happier? Which people, which music, which sights and colors do I respond best to? When I'm in a slump, do I let myself be there? Do I pull myself out? You know, all these sorts of questions are highly individual, and there's a wonderful range of options of treatments we can have at our fingertips, but knowing how we function is critical to choosing wisely from among the available ones.
Well, let me ask you this now on a separate topic. You know, we have auras. I mean, that's been proven. People have seen them. HeartMath has tested them. A lot of people have tested them. Do you think that biophotons are related to our auras?
You know, because most of my work is using very much conventional medicine and studies in journals, it's just on an area I have much familiarity in. So I'd have to say that I'd have to defer to somebody who is more aware of that area than me, because I just don't know enough to answer.
All right. That's a fair answer. I'd rather you tell me that than tell me something that didn't make any sense. So, well, let's talk a minute about
you. I can make something up either, but...
I think that's the problem in science, isn't it?
Except well, again, what Norm Cheney and I are saying in our book, Soul Medicine, is that there's so much good science, there's so much solid science behind all this new wave of healing, we don't need to rely on fringe science to demonstrate it. It just is necessary. That it doesn't require faith or even belief. Belief certainly helps. But the evidence is so compelling for the efficacy of all these kinds of interventions like prayer and meditation and states of consciousness, states of mind, states of emotional being. The evidence is so compelling that these are remarkably effective in healing that we don't need explanations that don't rely on science. In fact, one of the fascinating sets of the early experiments performed in the 70s was when the researchers hooked up various kinds of healers to EEG machines, and so they read the brainwave frequencies of people who were doing healing. And they hooked up a wide variety of healers. They hooked up Christian faith healers. They hooked up Tibetan lamas. They hooked up Hawaiian hunas. They hooked up all kinds of people who did healings. And their brain scans and their brainwave states were very, very different, as you can imagine. However, when they moved into the healing space, their brain scans were almost identical. You could lay one over the other, and you couldn't tell whose was which. They all moved into the frequency of about 8 hertz, 8 cycles per second, so 8 beats per second. All of their brains were in this. So some of them believed in Jesus Christ. Some of them believed in the Buddha or Kuan Yin. Some believed in the Great Kahuna. But all these different belief systems. So, you know, pick your belief, but if you're going to a faith healer, the chances are that if they can move into that state, regardless of their belief system, that will be some kind of healing effect that occurs.
Sounds like some interesting science that supports the notion that there's one God or one higher power.
Yes, yes. In fact, many healing prayers begin that way. It's simply related to the higher power. And that's, Larry Doffy emphasizes non-directed prayer. You know, don't pray for a particular specific outcome. Pray for the highest good.
Well, let's talk about EMFs then. I think we know that nerve impulses carry information. Would you agree with me?
I would, and I would also say that they are one of our body's signaling mechanisms, and while conventional biomedicine believes that they are the only or the primary signaling mechanism, new science is pointing to the existence of a whole other set of signaling mechanisms which are much faster and much more efficient than neural transmission and occur at roughly 3 to 50 times the speed of neural transmission.
And what do you mean? Is that something contained within neurotransmitters, or is that something else?
It is a whole different system. It's the energy system of the body. And your body, we've known for years, in 1924, Willem van Eindhoven, a Dutch physician, received the Nobel Prize in Medicine for demonstrating that the heart had its own electrical field.
Right.
And so since then, in the development of the EKG and the other machines, we've understood that all our organs have these fields. We know now that our brains have their own magnetic fields. And so there's a huge body. I mean, things like the heart pacemaker are the result of advances in this field. fMRI machines, EKGs, EEGs, this is all part of electrical medicine. And electrical and magnetic impulses are conveyed through the body much faster than the chemical transmission via sodium and chloride along our nerve cells. So we're starting to identify these other ways of transmission having to do with energy that are very, very fast. In fact, some of them appear to be almost instantaneous, going the speed of light or even faster.
Would you measure that through the stochastic resonance of the cells?
It definitely has something to do with the frequency of the cell and some cells picking up certain signals better or faster than others. Again, we're just at the beginnings of our understanding of these kinds of mechanisms. We know they're there. It's been astonishing to discover that they're there because for roughly 150 years, the dogma has been that nerve impulse transmission is how information gets conveyed in the body. And it now looks like it's a way, but it's one of several ways, and it's certainly a great deal slower than electrical information being transmitted.
Well, one of the reasons I was asking about the nerve impulse and the EMFs is because, you know, glioblastoma brain tumors are at the highest number they've ever been, and particularly in children. And I've done some research on the internet on this, you know, because Andrew Frykel at, what is it, California Pacific at Davis, is doing research on that with distant healing. But I found during this research that a lot of the children that had these things live in proximity to a nuclear waste site, such as radiation. And these cells, they quadruple instead of just doubling. And I'm, you know, with those fields, if they change the nerve impulse pattern, it would be logical to me that would interfere with these neurons firing in the brain and causing these firing signals to get off. And I was talking to a friend of mine named Larry Burke, I met through Marilyn Schlitz, who was a radiologist at Duke.
Right.
And he told me, I asked him this question, could that be causing all of these glioblastomas? And he said, well, you know, one day I was standing in the lab with a friend of mine, and he had two petri dishes of glial cells. And I asked him what would happen if he was exposed one of those to an MRI machine, and the guy said, I don't know, let's do it. So they did. They put one petri dish in the MRI for 15 minutes, and the other one they just let sit there. And 3 days later, the one in the petri dish that got exposed to the MRI had quadrupled. Well, that, to me, even though that's not a study that's been, you know, conducted and repetitive studies done on it, to me, that should tell somebody something, that these EMF fields are doing something to cause these erratic cancers to come that there's no cure for.
Well, Eva, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. One of the ways in which science progresses is that there are certain things we know or we're fairly sure of, and then there are usually many little anomalous ideas and suggestions around the field of our awareness. And it takes a while, usually, for those to be organized to any kind of coherent body of research or into a theory that we can test and then confirm. And so, again, this is one of those areas where we know something may be happening, but we're a long way from having a definitive idea of exactly what is happening. And eventually, when enough suggestions build up that something is happening in a field, then eventually somebody puts it all together and comes with a new theory that guides further research. So what your friend did with the cells is one of those little interesting bits of evidence that no one has yet organized into a coherent body of research and proof. And so what happens is eventually that does happen, and science does progress that way. But there are always a lot of things that are just out there, and we haven't yet tested or experimented on thoroughly.
Well, wouldn't it make sense that we know that EMFs evoke changes? Wouldn't it be logical that that could be something that would happen?
Well, there are so many... there are so many things that need to be studied like that, and right now I'm trying to raise money actually for some studies of medical effects that I think are important, and it's just the number of potential studies is so great, and the amount of money is pretty limited, and so researchers have to really pick our shots as to where that money should be spent. So maybe there is something going on there, but until there's research funding and a laboratory, it's going to be hard to pin down what it is.
All right. Well, let's talk a minute about consciousness. You refer to consciousness throughout your book. What is your definition of consciousness? And I'm asking you that because I was in the grocery store one day talking to a medical doctor, and I asked him his definition of consciousness, and he looked at me like I was crazy and said, well, it's the opposite of being in a coma. And I said, well, is that all? And he said, well, what else is there? So I realized there's this huge language barrier about the word consciousness. What is your definition of that?
In the second chapter of Soul Medicine, there's one of my favorite quotes. It's from Sir Arthur Eddington, who was a physicist in the early part of the last century. And here's what he said. The stuff of the world is mind stuff. This mind stuff is not spread in space and time. Recognizing that the physical world is entirely abstract and without actuality apart from its linkage to consciousness, we restore consciousness to the fundamental position. And consciousness is the place we have to start when we're looking at healing. Right now, it's looked upon as an interesting curiosity, or what philosophers and scientists sometimes call an epiphenomenon of matter. Mm-hmm. That is, in my opinion, is a completely erroneous view. What they believe is that life, the Big Bang happened, the Earth eventually cooled, eventually there were simple forms of life, trees, eventually simple fish crawl on land briefly, then there were land creatures, plants, and so on. And then eventually, at some point, the first mammal, or the first advanced life form showed something akin to consciousness, and then consciousness developed, and the pinnacle of consciousness is the human, magnificent human brain. That point of view, that consciousness is what they call an epiphenomenon of matter. In other words, matter evolves and becomes so complex eventually that it gives rise to consciousness. That's the traditional view. But what scientists have been hinting at now for the last 100 years or so is that actually matter appears to arise from consciousness. Einstein gave us a great gift in his equation, E equals mc squared, because it on one side of the equation is E, and on the other, or energy, on the other side is matter. And the idea that there is a transference between matter and energy is a remarkable idea. Some healers say that when they do a healing, for example, there's one in soul medicine, there's one particular healer we write about a lot, and his theory was that when people with cancer would come to him, and their cancerous cells would disappear, their cancers would literally disappear, sometimes within a few days. Huge cancerous lumps would simply shrink and disappear. And this particular healer felt that it was matter turning into energy, that energy could inform negative thoughts, could become matter, condensed into cancer. And his belief was that in the healing process, that matter shifted back into energy and was dissipated by the energy of the healer. So we're now realizing that in a very real sense, matter arises from consciousness, and that consciousness isn't just something that is the product of neural evolution. That in a very real sense, we are affecting our bodies, our lives, our genes, and everything around us with our consciousness and the kinds of larger consciousness in which we share.
Okay. You have to think about that answer. It's a detailed answer.
Well, yeah, it has to do with consciousness and healing, because it's become abundantly obvious to us as we looked at hundreds of case histories and over 100 scientific studies, and it is absolutely clear to me that when your consciousness changes, it affects your body.
Yes.
You are doing genetic engineering in this moment, Eva, and I am too, and every listener is doing genetic engineering. They're turning genes on and off in their own bodies right this very second by the quality of their consciousness, whether mm-hmm. they allow their mind to revolve around the insult that Harry gave me at the office last Friday before the long weekend, or whether they're filling their minds, whether they're listening to this program and saying, hey, I have the power to shift the frequency I tune into on my own from among the whole spectrum of thoughts I could have. I choose the ones which will support my health, my well-being, my happiness. And you definitely can make those choices, and they undoubtedly affect your physical health.
Do you think that consciousness is conveyed, or it's got to be presented somehow? Do you think that it's conveyed, or that we interpret it through frequencies and voltage, maybe?
I think that many different states of consciousness are present simultaneously,
mm-hmm.
and that they do have different frequencies, and that we can choose which of those we tune into. And I'll give you a very simple example from my own life. I usually wake up in the morning grouchy. I just do. Don't know why I do, but I do. I wake up, I like just bite off the head of everyone around me. That's just, I don't know why, just the way I wake up. So I wake up every morning.
I can relate.
Yes, this is a common condition. So I wake up, for 30 years I've been doing this. I wake up in the morning, I feel grouchy, and I simply decide that if grouchiness is KFZT, then I will tune to KRGN, another radio station. I simply retune my consciousness to relate to gratitude. And suddenly, it takes only a second. My entire experience of the day shifts. Mm-hmm. I feel this flood of gratitude pouring through me, not for anything, just simple, unattached gratitude, just for being present, just for being there. And so by taking control of my consciousness and shifting to a different frequency, I then live on that frequency throughout the day. Right. If I didn't take control of my consciousness, if I didn't make that shift, I'd have a miserable day, my children would have a miserable day, my clients would have a bad day, my co-workers, I would spread the misery around all around me. But by taking the frequency of mass consciousness, and again, there is such a thing as a mass or global consciousness, by simply picking one of love and compassion and joy, by tuning into that frequency, I then am able to propagate and amplify that frequency, and guess what is going through all my cells? Those same researchers at HeartMath have found that just 5 minutes in the morning of thinking about a positive memory, 5 minutes elevates your immune system immediately, and it remains elevated throughout the day. The effect lasts 5 to 8 hours thereafter. So you're actually boosting your immune system dramatically by just 5 minutes. So imagine if we do half an hour and just focus on that vibration in the mass consciousness and not on all of the sick, sad, miserable, awful things that are also there. Sure, those things are there. We don't have to deny them, but we don't have to immerse ourselves in them either, because they are dreadful for our bodies, they are dreadful for our health, and one of the fastest and best things you can do to take control of your health is to shift your thinking, shift your awareness, and start to consciously tune in to the things that support good health and a positive experience.
Well, one of the reasons I asked that question, and we don't have a lot of time, we've got about 10 or 15 minutes, but I've been doing this interview, I hadn't got to all the questions with you because we've been off on this other stuff, but I think that one day, through the work of people like HeartMath, you know, it's obvious something's going on with that stochastic resonance. It's obvious that that electromagnetic field has something to do with it, you know, with the heart. And I think that after talking with Roland one day, he said, you know, all we have to do is figure out the spaces in between those time-space pulse intervals. Obviously, that sounds easy, but it's quite a complicated thing. And I think that frequency is an important thing to understand when it comes to that. And I don't think these hardcore scientists even acknowledge it, because they confuse our word of frequency with something in hardcore physics, and so they don't want to address it. But I think that, you know, we do have gradients of consciousness, and everybody in the world has a different level of understanding. You know, I can talk to somebody about something in consciousness, and it'd be like talking to a telephone pole, and they would think that I was a know-it-all. But it's important for science to understand that there's something going on with frequencies, even though I don't know what the right word is there. And we have to do something, choose a better word, or elaborate on what we mean by frequencies, because it's making science not buy what we have to say. Does that make any sense?
That's why in my books, like in Soul Medicine, I talk about electromagnetic frequencies. I don't talk about subtle energies. I don't talk about spirits, angels, or a supernatural realm. Because, again, you can use those beliefs if they bolster your immune system or your faith, but they're not necessary. All of this is explainable, I've found, in pretty mainstream physical science concepts.
When so I asked that,
I qualify energy by saying electromagnetic energy.
It was Fred Allen Wolf, actually. I asked him, I said, do you think information is encoded in frequencies? And he went, so what? So what? What does that matter? How does that help mankind? But I think with the work that you're doing and with what Roland and them doing, it's very important down the road. We may not know what it is right now, but it's important to research. Do you not think?
Oh, vitally important. And it's not important to research as though it were pure science, although that can be done as well. But it's vital that we research this because it has such a dramatic effect on our bodies. Think, for example, about pain sufferers and about people who are in pain. I don't know what the figures are, but there are, you know, something like 40 million Americans who have chronic pain. The number is enormous. And some of these energy therapies that we have links to on our soulmedicineinstitute.com site have dramatic effects on people's perceived levels of pain. So we can reduce human suffering dramatically. Another example, these energy therapies are being used with people in crisis situations. There's a team right now in Pakistan helping earthquake survivors get over the trauma. Other teams have gone into Kosovo after massacres of Kosovars, Serbs, and they are working with massacre survivors. And these techniques are so powerful that they can remove the emotional trauma associated with seeing your whole village gunned down before your eyes. The power of these new medical techniques, new psychological techniques, is way beyond anything else we have in our healing arsenal. So there ought to be, in fact there will be, there is, there should be a huge drive. And again, right now I've just begun to say, I've got to sell my second car or do something to raise funds for these studies, because they are so important and they can be so effective in leaving human suffering. They've got to get done, and the science behind this has got to catch up with the clinical experience of therapists using these techniques.
Well, I think like in Roland's work, I think that if we could, you know, that the further frequency study needs to be done, because look what it could do to prevent illness. If you could test somebody's electromagnetic field, and I know they're working on this, and get a certain frequency, and that frequency, after enough experimentation, you would know that if somebody was at their frequency, that in 5 years they were going to have lung cancer. I mean, that's tremendous.
Yes, healers describe this. Qigong artists describe this. Harold Saxton Burr, a Yale psychologist in the 50s, said that there are various frequencies that show up years before the disease concretizes into an organic ailment, that these show up in the energy field of the patient. And so you then begin to treat things way, way, way early. In fact, you get beyond the notion that we start working on these issues when we get sick. You start every day, you scan your body, you scan your cells, you scan your brain, you say, what unhealthy beliefs, attitudes, affirmations, what am I saying? What mental self-talk is going on there in my mind? And start to take responsibility for mental hygiene, for emotional hygiene. I may feel angry and upset, but I do not then propagate that by lashing out and hurting other people. I use an energy technique, I dissipate that energy, and then I move cleanly into my world. So if we think of ourselves as giving ourselves a tune-up every day and make sure energy is good, then we are solving these problems way before they get to the level of us having a serious disease we have to cope with. Now, they can help those diseases, but again, the energy tune-up, I think, is very important.
I do, too. I mean, it's been proven that it works. But let me ask you a question. When we use the word frequency, what do you mean by that word?
What I mean by that word is when I say that, for example, the brain waves of healers are all at about 8 hertz, and actually the frequency, the specific one, is between 7 and 10 hertz.
Are you talking about the rate of oscillation of
yes.
the cell?
That's the number of cycles per second of the brain scans of healers during the healing event. is between 7 and 10 cycles per second. It also happens to be the frequency of the planet Earth. Earth itself has a base wave in that frequency range. So, that's what I mean. Yeah, the pulses are at that frequency.
I can't understand. I mean, these materialist scientists that I've been interviewing, I can't understand why they don't find importance in that. I just can't grasp why they blow it off, because it seems to be so significant to me.
Yes, I know. And it does take people rooted in conventional scientists. I've talked to people involved in DNA research, and even when confronted with the evidence in the studies, there's a wall sometimes, I've found, of denial. And it's very peculiar because scientists are supposed to be looking for the truth. And I think that they're often so wedded to their conventional theories that when the truth is being slapped in their faces like a dead wet herring.
It's flabbergasting, you know. All right, we've got 3 minutes left. And I want to ask you about what you were telling me earlier today on the phone about that negative charge in that sick uterus. Tell me about that.
That was a study which showed that women who had cancerous or precancerous tumors in their uteruses had a negative charge in the uterus, and those that had healthy uteruses had a positive electrical charge. Again, when I say charge or frequency, I mean electrical frequencies.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe causes that charge? Would it be more electrons oscillating?
Well, there's electrical charge, and as far as the cause goes, in soul medicine, we say there are three pillars of soul medicine. One is that human beings are energy systems. The second pillar is intention. Mm-hmm. And the third is consciousness. So having a certain consciousness and that consciousness expressing an intention is what then has ripple healing effects throughout the body.
Well, let's just talk about the physiology of it, the actual organs. What would cause the negative charge? Would that be electrons?
Yes.
The reason I ask that question is because, you know, when we think thoughts positive or negative, something's got to make it positive or negative in an electromagnetic field. I mean, it's something.
Yes, well, that just means it has a preponderance of electrons.
So I wonder if, you know, when we think a negative thought, are we oscillating more electrons? Or if it's positive, do we oscillate more protons? Is that why what goes around comes around?
That
would be a logical reason.
I think that, I don't think it's quite that simple. I think these effects are very, very complex. And even, you know, why do so many healers die young? That's one thing we talk about in our book, Soul Medicine. Why do so many healers die young? There are many anomalies in this field as well, and we're not at the point yet where we can make simple cause and effect correlations between some of these factors. What we do know, though, is that, again, when you really work with your own consciousness, when you keep your consciousness free of negative thoughts and harmful emotions, that it has dramatic effects on your body and your health. That we know for sure in general.
Yeah, we know that.
But the specifics we don't know.
Well, we're out of time, Dawson. If you have one thing to say to the world that you thought would or could make a difference, what would that be?
Feel in control of your health, your destiny, and your life by watching what you think and say and do, and focus on making that impeccably loving, compassionate, and pure. Because if you do this, you're supporting your own physical health, your own emotional health, your own spiritual health, and the health of everyone around you. And you, as a healthy person, then, are a healthy cell helping our whole planet be a healthy planet. So every day, taking impeccable responsibility for every single thing you say, everything you think, absolutely every part of your life, allowing it to reflect the absolute highest you're capable of, is the best thing you can possibly do for yourself and the world.
That's right. That's the name of this show, The Healing of Agape. Thank you, Dawson, and I hope you'll come back again. And agape to you, my friend.
Received, and thank you, and passed back to you. Thank you, Eva.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.